I have grown up, battling every inch of my way. I never knew you were unhappy, my child. Father, I always knew it. In this strife, I have almost repulsed and crushed my better angel into a demon. What I have learned has left me doubting, misbelieving, despising, regretting what I have not learned. And my dismal resource has been to think that life would soon go by, and that nothing in it could be worth the pain and trouble of a contest. And you so young, Louisa, he said with pity. And I so young. In this condition, Father, for I show you now without fear or favour the ordinary deadened state of my mind as I know it, you proposed my husband to me. I took him. I never made a pretense to him or you that I loved him. I knew, and Father, you knew and he knew, that I never did. I was not wholly indifferent, for I had a hope of being pleasant and useful to Tom. I made that wild escape into something visionary, and have slowly found out how wild it was. But Tom had been the subject of all the little tenderness of my life. Perhaps he became so because I knew so well how to pity him. It matters little now, except as it may dispose you to think more leniently of his errors. As her father held her in his arms, she put her other hand upon his other shoulder, and still looking fixedly in his face, went on. When I was irrevocably married, there rose up into rebellion against the tie, the old strife, made fiercer by all those causes of disparity which arise out of our two individual natures, and which no general laws shall ever rule or state for me, Father, until they shall be able to direct the anatomist where to strike his knife into the secrets of my soul. Louisa, he said, and said imploringly, for he well remembered what had passed between them in their former interview. I do not reproach you, Father. I make no complaint. I am here with another object. What can I do, child? Ask me what you will. I am coming to it. Father, chance then threw into my way a new acquaintance. A man such as I had had no experience of. Used to the world, light, polished, easy, making no pretenses, avowing the low estimate of everything that I was half afraid to form in secret, conveying to me almost immediately, though I don't know how or by what degrees, that he understood me and read my thoughts. I could not find that he was worse than I. There seemed to be a near affinity between us. I only wondered it should be worth his while, who cared for nothing else, to care so much for me. For you, Louisa? Her father might instinctively have loosened his hold, but that he felt her strength departing from her and saw a wild, dilating fire in the eyes, steadfastly regarding him. I say nothing of his plea for claiming my confidence. It matters very little how he gained it. Father, he did gain it. What you know of the story of my marriage, he soon knew just as well. Her father's face was ashy white, and he held her in both his arms. I have done no worse. I have not disgraced you. But if you ask me whether I have loved him, or do love him, I tell you plainly, Father, that it may be so. I don't know. She took her hands suddenly from his shoulders and pressed them both upon her side, while in her face, not like itself, and in her figure drawn up resolute to finish by a last effort what she had to say, the feelings long suppressed broke loose. This night, my husband being away, he has been with me, declaring himself my lover. This minute he expects me, for I could release myself of his presence by no other means. I do not know that I am sorry. I do not know that I am ashamed. I do not know that I am degraded in my own esteem. All that I know is, your philosophy and your teaching will not save me. Now, Father, you have brought me to this. Save me by some other means. He tightened his hold in time to prevent her sinking on the floor, but she cried out in a terrible voice, I shall die if you hold me. Let me fall upon the ground. And he laid her down there, and saw the pride of his heart and the triumph of his system lying an insensible heap at his feet.
Book the Third, Garnering. Chapter 1. Another Thing Needful. Louisa awoke from a torpor, and her eyes languidly opened on her old bed at home and her old room. It seemed at first as if all that had happened since the days when these objects were familiar to her were the shadows of a dream, but gradually, as the objects became more real to her sight, the events became more real to her mind. She could scarcely move her head for pain and heaviness. Her eyes were strained and sore, and she was very weak. A curious, passive inattention had such possession of her that the presence of her little sister in the room did not attract her notice for some time. Even when their eyes had met and her sister had approached the bed, Louisa lay for minutes looking at her in silence, and suffering her timidly to hold her passive hand before she asked, "When was I brought to this room?"
"Last night, Louisa."
"Who brought me here?"
"Sissy, I believe."
"Why do you believe so?"
"Because I found her here this morning. She didn't come to my bedside to wake me, as she always does, and I went to look for her. She was not in her own room, either, and I went looking for her all over the house until I found her here, taking care of you and cooling your head. Will you see Father? Sissy said I was to tell him when you woke."
"What a beaming face you have, Jane," said Louisa, as her young sister, timidly still, bent down to kiss her.
"Have I? I'm very glad you think so. I'm sure it must be Sissy's doing."
The arm Louisa had begun to twine around her neck unbent itself.
"You can tell Father, if you will."
Then, staying her for a moment, she said,
"It was you who made my room look so cheerful and gave it this look of welcome." "Oh, no, Louisa, it was done before I came. It was..."
Louisa turned upon her pillow and heard no more. When her sister had withdrawn, she turned her head back again and lay with her face towards the door until it opened and her father entered. He had a jaded, anxious look upon him, and his hand, usually steady, trembled in hers. He sat down at the side of the bed, tenderly asking how she was, and dwelling on the necessity of her keeping very quiet after her agitation and exposure to the weather last night. He spoke in a subdued and troubled voice, very differently from his usual dictatorial manner, and was often at a loss for words.
"My dear Louisa, my poor daughter."
He was so much at a loss at that place that he stopped altogether. He tried again.
"My unfortunate child."
The place was so difficult to get over that he tried again.
"It would be hopeless for me, Louisa, to endeavour to tell you how overwhelmed I have been, and still am, by what broke upon me last night. The ground on which I stand has ceased to be solid under my feet. The only support on which I leaned, and the strength of which it seemed, and still does seem, impossible to question, has given way in an instant. I am stunned by these discoveries. I have no selfish meaning in what I say, but I find the shock of what broke upon me last night to be very heavy indeed."
She could give him no comfort herein. She had suffered the wreck of her whole life upon the rock.
"I will not say, Louisa, that if you had by any happy chance undeceived me some time ago, it would have been better for us both, better for your peace and better for mine, for I am sensible that it may not have been a part of my system to invite any confidence of that kind. I had proved my system to myself, and I have rigidly administered it, and I must bear the responsibility of its failures. I only entreat you to believe, my favourite child, that I have meant to do right."
He said it earnestly, and to do him justice, he had. Engaging fathomless deeps with his little mean excise rod, and in staggering over the universe with his rusty stiff-legged compasses, he had meant to do great things. Within the limits of his short tether, he had tumbled about, annihilating the flowers of existence with greater singleness of purpose than many of the blatant personages whose company he kept. I am well assured of what you say, Father. I know I have been your favourite child. I know you have intended to make me happy. I have never blamed you, and I never shall."
He took her outstretched hand and retained it in his.
"My dear, I have remained all night at my table, pondering again and again on what has so painfully passed between us. When I consider your character, when I consider that what has been known to me for hours has been concealed by you for years, when I consider under what immediate pressure it has been forced from you at last, I come to the conclusion that I cannot but mistrust myself."
He might have added, more than all, when he saw the face now looking at him. He did add it, in effect, perhaps, as he softly moved her scattered hair from her forehead with his hand. Such little actions, slight in another man, were very noticeable in him, and his daughter received them as if they had been words of contrition. "But," said Mr. Gradgrind, slowly and with hesitation, as well as with a wretched sense of happiness, "if I see reason to mistrust myself for the past, Louisa, I should also mistrust myself for the present and the future. To speak unreservedly to you, I do. I am far from feeling convinced now, however differently I might have felt only this time yesterday, that I am fit for the trust you repose in me, that I know how to respond to the appeal you have come home to make to me, that I have the right instinct, supposing it for the moment to be some quality of that nature, how to help you and to set you right, my child."
She had turned upon her pillow and lay with her face upon her arm so that he could not see it. All her wildness and passion had subsided, but though softened, she was not in tears. Her father was changed in nothing so much as in the respect that he would have been glad to see her in tears. "Some persons hold," he pursued, still hesitating, "that there is a wisdom of the head, and that there is a wisdom of the heart. I have not supposed so. But as I have said, I mistrust myself now. I have supposed the head to be all-sufficient. It may not be all-sufficient. How can I venture this morning to say it is? If that other kind of wisdom should be what I have neglected, and should be the instinct that is wanted, Louisa..."
He suggested it very doubtfully, as if he were half unwilling to admit it, even now. She made him no answer. Lying before him on her bed, still half-dressed, much as he had seen her lying on the floor of his room last night.
"Louisa," and his hand rested on her hair again, "I have been absent from here, my dear, a good deal of late, and though your sister's training has been pursued according to the system,"
he appeared to come to that word with great reluctance always,
"it has necessarily been modified by daily associations, begun in her case at an early age. I ask you, ignorantly and humbly, my daughter, for the better, do you think?"
"Father," she replied, without stirring, "if any harmony has been awakened in her young breast that was mute in mine until it turned to discord, let her thank heaven for it, and go upon her happier way, taking it as her greatest blessing that she has avoided my way." "Oh, my child," he said in a forlorn manner, "I am an unhappy man to see you thus. What avails it to me that you do not reproach me if I so bitterly reproach myself?"
He bent his head and spoke low to her.
"Louisa, I have a misgiving that some change may have been slowly working about me in this house by mere love and gratitude, that what the head had left undone and could not do, the heart may have been doing silently. Can it be so?"
She made him no reply.
"I am not too proud to believe it, Louisa. How could I be arrogant and you before me? Can it be so? Is it so, my dear?"
He looked upon her once more, lying cast away there, and without another word went out of the room. He had not been long gone when she heard a light tread near the door and knew that someone stood beside her. She did not raise her head. a dull anger that she should be seen in her distress, and that the involuntary look she had so resented should come to this fulfillment, smouldered within her like an unwholesome fire. All closely imprisoned forces rend and destroy. The air that would be healthful to the earth, the water that would enrich it, the heat that would ripen it, tear it when caged up. So in her bosom, even now, the strongest qualities she possessed, long turned upon themselves, became a heap of obduracy that rose against a friend. It was well that soft touch came upon her neck, and that she understood herself to be supposed to have fallen asleep. The sympathetic hand did not claim her resentment. Let it lie there. Let it lie. It lay there, warming into life a crowd of gentler thoughts, and she rested. As she softened with the quiet and the consciousness of being so watched, some tears made their way into her eyes. The face touched hers, and she knew that there were tears upon it, too, and she the cause of them. As Louisa feigned to rouse herself and sat up, Sissy retired, so that she stood placidly near the bedside.
"I hope I have not disturbed you. I have come to ask if you would let me stay with you." "Why should you stay with me? My sister will miss you. You are everything to her."
"Am I?" returned Sissy, shaking her head.
"I would be something to you if I might."
"What?" said Louisa, almost sternly.
"Whatever you want most, if I could be that. At all events, I would like to try to be as near it as I can. And however far off that may be, I will never tire of trying. Will you let me?" "My father sent you to ask me."
"No, indeed," replied Sissy. "He told me that I might come in now, but he sent me away from the room this morning, or at least—"
She hesitated and stopped.
"At least what?" said Louisa, with her searching eyes upon her. "I thought it best myself that I should be sent away, for I felt very uncertain whether you would like to find me here. Have I always hated you so much?"
"I hope not, for I have always loved you, and have always wished that you should know it. But you changed to me a little shortly before you left home. Not that I wondered at it. You knew so much, and I knew so little, and it was so natural in many ways, going as you were among other friends, that I had nothing to complain of, and was not at all hurt."
Her colour rose as she said it, modestly and hurriedly. Louisa understood the loving pretense, and her heart smote her.
"May I try?" said Sissy,
emboldened to raise her hand to the neck that was insensibly drooping towards her. Louisa, taking down the hand that would have embraced her in another moment, held it in one of hers and answered,
"First, Sissy, do you know what I am? I am so proud and so hardened, so confused and troubled, so resentful and unjust to everyone and to myself, that everything is stormy, dark, and wicked to me. Does that not repel you?"
"No.
I am so unhappy, and all that should have made me otherwise is so laid waste that if I had been bereft of sense to this hour, and instead of being as learned as you think me, had to begin to acquire the simplest truths, I could not want a guide to peace, contentment, honour, all the good of which I am quite devoid, more abjectly than I do. Does that not repel you?"
"No."
In the innocence of her brave affection, and the brimming up of her old devoted spirit, the once deserted girl shone like a beautiful light upon the darkness of the other. Louisa raised the hand that it might clasp her neck and join its fellow there. She fell upon her knees, and clinging to this stroller's child, looked up at her almost with veneration.
"Forgive me. Pity me. Help me. Have compassion on my great need, and let me lay this head of mine upon a loving heart." "Oh, lay it here," cried Sissy. "Lay it here, my dear."
Chapter 2. Very Ridiculous. Mr. James Harthouse passed a whole night and a day in a state of so much hurry that the world, with its best glass in his eye, would scarcely have recognized him during that insane interval as the brother Jem of the honorable and jocular member. He was positively agitated. He several times spoke with an emphasis similar to the vulgar manner. He went in and went out in an unaccountable way, like a man without an object. He rode like a highwayman. In a word, he was so horribly bored by existing circumstances that he forgot to go in for boredom in the manner prescribed by the authorities. After putting his horse at Coketown through the storm as if it were a leap, he waited up all night, from time to time ringing his bell with the greatest fury, charging the porter who kept watch with delinquency in withholding letters or messages that could not fail to have been entrusted to him, and demanding restitution on the spot. The dawn coming, the morning coming, and the day coming, and neither message nor letter coming with either, he went down to the country house. There the report was Mr. Bounderby away, and Mrs. Bounderby in town, left for town suddenly last evening, not even known to be gone until receipt of message, importing that her return was not to be expected for the present. In these circumstances, he had nothing for it but to follow her to town. He went to the house in town. Mrs. Bounderby not there. He looked in at the bank. Mr. Bounderby away, and Mrs. Sparsit away. Mrs. Sparsit away? Who could have been reduced to sudden extremity for the company of that griffin? "Well, I don't know," said Tom, who had his own reasons for being uneasy about it. "She was off somewhere at daybreak this morning. She's always full of mystery. I hate her. So I do that white chap. He's always got his blinking eyes upon a fellow." "Where were you last night, Tom?" "Where was I last night?" said Tom. "Come, I like that. I was waiting for you, Mr. Harthouse, till it came down as I never saw it come down before. Where was I, too? Where were you, you mean?"
"I was prevented from coming. Detained."
"Detained," murmured Tom. "Two of us were detained. I was detained looking for you till I lost every train but the mail. It would have been a pleasant job to go down by that on such a night, and have to walk home through a pond. I was obliged to sleep in town, after all."
"Where?"
"Where? Why, in my own bed at Bounderby's."
"Did you see your sister?"
"How the deuce," returned Tom, staring, "could I see my sister when she was 15 miles off?" Cursing these quick retorts of the young gentleman to whom he was so true a friend, Mr. Harthouse disembarrassed himself of that interview with the smallest conceivable amount of ceremony, and debated for the 100th time what all this could mean. He made only one thing clear. It was that whether she was in town or out of town, whether he had been premature with her who was so hard to comprehend, or she had lost courage, or they were discovered, or some mischance or mistake at present incomprehensible had occurred, he must remain to confront his fortune, whatever it was. The hotel, where he was known to live when condemned to that region of blackness, was the stake to which he was tied. As to all the rest, what will be, will be. So, whether I am waiting for a hostile message, or an assignation, or a penitent remonstrance, or an impromptu wrestle with my friend Bounderby in the Lancashire manner, which would seem as likely as anything else in the present state of affairs, I'll dine, said Mr. James Harthouse. Bounderby has the advantage in point of weight, and if anything of a British nature is to come off between us, it may be as well to be in training. Therefore he rang the bell, and tossing himself negligently on a sofa, ordered some dinner at 6 with a beefsteak in it, and got through the intervening time as well as he could. That was not particularly well, for he remained in the greatest perplexity, and as the hours went on and no kind of explanation offered itself, his perplexity augmented at compound interest. However, he took affairs as coolly as it was in human nature to do, and entertained himself with the facetious idea of the training more than once. "It wouldn't be bad," he yawned at one time, "to give the waiter 5 shillings and throw him." At another time it occurred to him, "Or a fellow of about 13 or 14 stone might be hired by the hour." but these jests did not tell materially on the afternoon or his suspense, and sooth to say, they both lagged fearfully. It was impossible, even before dinner, to avoid often walking about in the pattern of the carpet, looking out of the window, listening at the door for footsteps, and occasionally becoming rather hot when any steps approached that room. But after dinner, when the day turned to twilight, and the twilight turned to night, and still no communication was made to him, it began to be, as he expressed it, like the holy office and slow torture. However, still true to his conviction that indifference was the genuine high breeding, the only conviction he had, he seized this crisis as the opportunity for ordering candles and a newspaper. He had been trying in vain for half an hour to read this newspaper when the waiter appeared and said, at once mysteriously and apologetically, "Beg your pardon, sir. You want it, sir, if you please." A general recollection that this was the kind of thing the police said to the swell mob caused Mr. Harthouse to ask the waiter in return with bristling indignation what the devil he meant by wanted. "Beg your pardon, sir. Young lady outside, sir, wishes to see you." "Outside? Where?" "Outside this door, sir." Giving the waiter to the personage before mentioned as a blockhead, duly qualified for that consignment, Mr. Harthouse hurried into the gallery. A young woman whom he had never seen stood there, plainly dressed, very quiet, very pretty. As he conducted her into the room and placed a chair for her, he observed by the light of the candles that she was even prettier than he had at first believed. Her face was innocent and youthful, and its expression remarkably pleasant. She was not afraid of him, or in any way disconcerted. She seemed to have her mind entirely preoccupied with the occasion of her visit, and have substituted that consideration for herself. "I speak to Mr. Harthouse," she said, when they were alone. "To Mr. Harthouse," he added in his mind, "and you speak to him with the most confiding eyes I ever saw, and the most earnest voice, though so quiet, I ever heard." "If I do not understand, and I do not, sir," said Sissy, "what your honour as a gentleman binds you to in other matters," the blood really rose in his face as she began in these words, "I am sure I may rely upon it to keep my visit secret, and to keep secret what I am going to say. I will rely upon it, if you will tell me I may so far trust." "You may, I assure you." "I am young, as you see. I am alone, as you see. In coming to you, sir, I have no advice or encouragement beyond my own hope." He thought, "But that is very strong," as he followed the momentary upward glance of her eyes. He thought, besides, "This is a very odd beginning. I don't see where we are going." "I think," said Sissy, "you have already guessed whom I left just now. I have been in the greatest concern and uneasiness during the last 24 hours, which have appeared as many years," he returned, "on a lady's account. The hopes I have been encouraged to form that you come from that lady do not deceive me, I trust. I left her within an hour." At her father's." Mr. Harthouse's face lengthened in spite of his coolness, and his perplexity increased. "Then I certainly," he thought, "do not see where we are going. She hurried there last night. She arrived there in great agitation and was insensible all through the night. I live at her father's and was with her. You may be sure, sir, you will never see her again as long as you live." Mr. Harthouse drew a long breath, and if ever man found himself in the position of not knowing what to say, made the discovery beyond all question that he was so circumstanced. The childlike ingenuousness with which his visitor spoke, her modest fearlessness, her truthfulness which put all artifice aside, her entire forgetfulness of herself in her earnest, quiet holding to the object with which she had come, all this, together with her reliance on his easily given promise, which in itself shamed him, presented something in which he was so inexperienced, and against which he knew any of his usual weapons would fall so powerless, that not a word could he rally to his relief. At last, he said, "So startling an announcement, so
confidently made and by such lips is really disconcerting in the last degree. May I be permitted to inquire if you are charged to convey that information to me in those hopeless words by the lady of whom we speak?
I have no charge from her.
The drowning man catches at the straw. With no disrespect for your judgment, and with no doubt of your sincerity, excuse my saying that I cling to the belief that there is yet hope that I am not condemned to perpetual exile from that lady's presence.
There is not the least hope. The first object of my coming here, sir, is to assure you that you must believe that there is no more hope of your ever speaking with her again than there would be if she had died when she came home last night.
Must believe. But if I can't, or if I should, by infirmity of nature, be obstinate and won't,
it is still true. There is no hope.
James Harthouse looked at her with an incredulous smile upon his lips, but her mind looked over and beyond him, and the smile was quite thrown away. He bit his lip and took a little time for consideration.
Well, if it should unhappily appear, he said, after due pains and duty on my part, that I am brought to a position so desolate as this banishment, I shall not become the lady's persecutor.
But you said you had no commission from her.
I have only the commission of my love for her, and her love for me. I have no other trust than that I have been with her since she came home, and that she has given me her confidence. I have no further trust than that I know something of her character and her marriage.
Oh, Mr. Harthouse, I think you had that trust too.
He was touched in the cavity where his heart should have been, in that nest of addled eggs where the birds of heaven would have lived if they had not been whistled away, by the fervour of this reproach. I am not a moral sort of fellow, he said, and I never make any pretensions to the character of a moral sort of fellow. I am as immoral as need be. At the same time, in bringing any distress upon the lady who is the subject of the present conversation, or in unfortunately compromising her in any way, or in committing myself by any expression of sentiments towards her not perfectly reconcilable with, in fact, with the domestic hearth, or in taking any advantage of her father's being a machine, or of her brother's being a whelp, or of her husband's being a bear, I beg to be allowed to assure you that I have had no particularly evil intentions, but have glided on from one step to another with a smoothness so perfectly diabolical that I had not the slightest idea the catalogue was half so long until I began to turn it over. Whereas I find, said Mr. James Harthouse in conclusion, that it is really in several volumes. Though he said all this in his frivolous way, the way seemed for that once a conscious polishing of but an ugly surface. He was silent for a moment, and then proceeded with a more self-possessed air, though with traces of vexation and disappointment that would not be polished out. After what has been just now represented to me, in a manner I find it impossible to doubt, I know of hardly any other source from which I could have accepted it so readily, I feel bound to say to you, in whom the confidence you have mentioned has been reposed, that I cannot refuse to contemplate the possibility, however unexpected, of my seeing the lady no more. I am solely to blame for the thing having come to this, and I cannot say, he added, rather hard up for a general peroration, that I have any sanguine expectation of ever becoming a moral sort of fellow, or that I have any belief in any moral sort of fellow, whatever.
Sissy's face sufficiently showed that her appeal to him was not finished.
You spoke, he resumed, as she raised her eyes to him again, of your first object. I may assume that there is a second to be mentioned?
Yes.
Will you oblige me by confiding it?
Mr. Harthouse, returned Sissy, with a blending of gentleness and steadiness that quite defeated him, and with a simple confidence in his being bound to do what she required that held him at a singular disadvantage.
The only reparation that remains with you is to leave here immediately and finally. I am quite sure that you can mitigate in no other way the wrong and harm you have done. I am quite sure that it is the only compensation you have left in your power to make. I do not say that it is much, or that it is enough, but it is something, and it is necessary. Therefore, though without any other authority than I have given you, and even without the knowledge of any other person than yourself and myself, I ask you to depart from this place tonight, under an obligation never to return to it.
If she had asserted any influence over him beyond her plain faith in the truth and right of what she said, if she had concealed the least doubt or irresolution, or had harbored for the best purpose any reserve or pretense, if she had shown or felt the lightest trace of any sensitiveness to his ridicule or his astonishment, or any remonstrance he might offer, he would have carried it against her at this point. But he could as easily have changed a clear sky by looking at it in surprise as affect her.
"But do you know," he asked, quite at a loss, "the extent of what you ask? You probably are not aware that I am here on a public kind of business, preposterous enough in itself, but which I have gone in for and sworn by, and am supposed to be devoted to in quite a desperate manner. You probably are not aware of that, but I assure you it's a fact."
It had no effect on Sissy, fact or no fact.
"Besides which," said Mr. Harthouse, taking a turn or two across the room dubiously, "it's so alarmingly absurd. It would make a man so ridiculous, after going in for these fellows, to back out in such an incomprehensible way."
"I am quite sure," repeated Sissy, "that it is the only reparation in your power, sir. I am quite sure, or I would not have come here."
He glanced at her face and walked about again.
"Upon my soul, I don't know what to say.
So immensely absurd."
It fell to his lot now to stipulate for secrecy.
"If I were to do such a very ridiculous thing," he said, stopping again presently and leaning against the chimney-piece, "it could only be in the most inviolable confidence."
"I will trust to you, sir," returned Sissy. "And you will trust to me."
His leaning against the chimney-piece reminded him of the night with the whelp. It was the self-same chimney-piece, and somehow he felt as if he were the whelp tonight. He could make no way at all.
"I suppose a man never was placed in a more ridiculous position," he said, after looking down and looking up, and laughing and frowning, and walking off and walking back again. "But I see no way out of it. What will be, will be. This will be, I suppose. I must take off myself, I imagine. In short, I engage to do it."
Sissy rose. She was not surprised by the result, but she was happy in it, and her face beamed brightly.
"You will permit me to say," continued Mr. James Harthouse, "that I doubt if any other ambassador or ambassadress could have addressed me with the same success. I must not only regard myself as being in a very ridiculous position, but as being vanquished at all points. Will you allow me the privilege of remembering my enemy's name?"
"My name," said the ambassadress,
"the only name I could possibly care to know tonight.
Sissy Jupe."
"Pardon my curiosity at parting. Related to the family?"
"I am only a poor girl," returned Sissy. "I was separated from my father. He was only a stroller, and taken pity on by Mr. Gradgrind. I've lived in the house ever since."
She was gone. "It wanted this to complete the defeat," said Mr. James Harthouse, sinking with a resigned air on the sofa after standing transfixed a little while. "The defeat may now be considered perfectly accomplished. Only a poor girl. Only a stroller. Only James Harthouse made nothing of. Only James Harthouse, a great pyramid of failure."
The Great Pyramid put it into his head to go up the Nile. He took a pen upon the instant and wrote the following note, in appropriate hieroglyphics, to his brother. "Dear Jack, all up at Coketown, bored out of the place and going in for camels. Affectionately, Jem." He rang the bell. "Send my fellow here."
"Gone to bed, sir."
"Tell him to get up and pack up." He wrote two more notes,
one to Mr. Bounderby, announcing his retirement from that part of the country, and showing where he would be found for the next fortnight. The other, similar in effect, to Mr. Gradgrind. Almost as soon as the ink was dry upon their superscriptions, he had left the tall chimneys of Coketown behind, and was in a railway carriage, tearing and glaring over the dark landscape. The moral sort of fellows might suppose that Mr. James Harthouse derived some comfortable reflections afterwards from this prompt retreat, as one of his few actions that made any amends for anything, and as a token to himself that he had escaped the climax of a very bad business. But it was not so at all. A secret sense of having failed and been ridiculous, a dread of what other fellows who went in for similar sorts of things would say at his expense if they knew it, so oppressed him that what was about the very best passage in his life was the one of all the others he would not have owned to on any account, and the only one that made him ashamed of himself. Chapter 3. Very Decided. The indefatigable Mrs. Sparsit, with a violent cold upon her, her voice reduced to a whisper, and her stately frame so racked by continual sneezes that it seemed in danger of dismemberment, gave chase to her patron until she found him in the metropolis. And there, majestically sweeping in upon him at his hotel in St. James's Street, exploded the combustibles with which she was charged, and blew up. Having executed her mission with infinite relish, this high-minded woman then fainted away on Mr. Bounderby's coat-collar. Mr. Bounderby's first procedure was to shake Mrs. Sparsit off and leave her to progress as she might through various stages of suffering on the floor. He next had recourse to the administration of potent restoratives, such as screwing the patient's thumbs, smiting her hands, abundantly watering her face, and inserting salt in her mouth. When these attentions had recovered her, which they speedily did, he hustled her into a fast train without offering any other refreshment, and carried her back to Coketown more dead than alive. Regarded as a classical ruin, Mrs. Sparsit was an interesting spectacle on her arrival at her journey's end, but considered in any other light, the amount of damage she had by that time sustained was excessive and impaired her claims to admiration. Utterly heedless of the wear and tear of her clothes and constitution, and adamant to her pathetic sneezes, Mr. Bounderby immediately crammed her into a coach and bore her off to Stone Lodge. "Now, Tom Gradgrind," said Bounderby, bursting into his father-in-law's room late at night, "here's a lady here, Mrs. Sparsit, you know Mrs. Sparsit, who has something to say to you that will strike you dumb."
"You have missed my letter," exclaimed Mr. Gradgrind, surprised by the apparition.
"Missed your letter, sir?" bawled Bounderby. "The present time is no time for letters. No man shall talk to Josiah Bounderby of Coketown about letters with his mind in the state it's in now."
"Bounderby," said Mr. Gradgrind, in a tone of temperate remonstrance, "I speak of a very special letter I have written to you in reference to Louisa."
"Tom Gradgrind," replied Bounderby, knocking the flat of his hand several times with great vehemence on the table. "I speak of a very special messenger that has come to me in reference to Louisa. Mrs. Sparsit, ma'am, stand forward."
That unfortunate lady hereupon essaying to offer testimony without any voice, and with painful gestures expressive of an inflamed throat, became so aggravating and underwent so many facial contortions that Mr. Bounderby, unable to bear it, seized her by the arm and shook her.
"If you can't get it out, ma'am," said Bounderby, "leave me to get it out. This is not a time for a lady, however highly connected, to be totally inaudible and seemingly swallowing marbles. Tom Gradgrind, Mrs. Sparsit latterly found herself, by accident, in a situation to overhear a conversation out of doors between your daughter and your precious gentleman friend, Mr. James Harthouse."
"Indeed," said Mr. Gradgrind.
"Ah, indeed," cried Bounderby. "And in that conversation—"
"It is not necessary to repeat its tenor, Bounderby. I know what passed."
"You do?"
"Perhaps," said Bounderby, staring with all his might at his so quiet and assuasive father-in-law. "Undoubtedly. She is here."
"Here?"
"My dear Bounderby, let me beg you to restrain those loud outbreaks on all account. Louisa is here.
the moment she could detach herself from that interview with the person of whom you speak, and whom I deeply regret to have been the means of introducing to you, Louisa hurried here for protection. I myself had not been at home many hours when I received her here in this room. She hurried by the train to town. She ran from town to this house through a raging storm and presented herself before me in a state of distraction. Of course, she has remained here ever since. Let me entreat you, for your own sake and for hers, to be more quiet. Mr. Bounderby silently gazed about him for some moments in every direction except Mrs. Sparsit's direction, and then, abruptly turning upon the niece of Lady Scadgers, said to that wretched woman, "Now, ma'am, we shall be happy to hear any little apology you may think proper to offer for going about the country at express pace with no other luggage than a cock and bull, ma'am."
"Sir," whispered Mrs. Sparsit, "my nerves are at present too much shaken, and my health is at present too much impaired in your service, to admit of my doing more than taking refuge in tears."
Which she did. "Well, ma'am," said Bounderby, "without making any observation to you that may not be made with propriety to a woman of good family, what I have got to add to that is that there is something else in which it appears to me you may take refuge, namely a coach. And the coach in which we came here being at the door, you'll allow me to hand you down to it and pack you home to the bank. But the best course for you to pursue will be to put your foot into the hottest water you can bear and take a glass of scalding rum and butter after you get into bed." With these words, Mr. Bounderby extended his right hand to the weeping lady and escorted her to the conveyance in question, shedding many plaintive sneezes by the way. He soon returned alone. "Now, as you showed me in your face, Tom Gradgrind, that you wanted to speak to me," he resumed, "here I am. But I am not in a very agreeable state, I tell you plainly, not relishing this business, even as it is, and not considering that I am at any time as dutifully and submissively treated by your daughter as Josiah Bounderby of Coketown ought to be treated by his wife. You have your opinion, I dare say, and I have mine, I know. If you mean to say anything to me tonight that goes against this candid remark, you had better let it alone." Mr. Gradgrind, it will be observed, being much softened, Mr. Bounderby took particular pains to harden himself at all points. It was his amiable nature. "My dear Bounderby," Mr. Gradgrind began in reply.
"Now, you'll excuse me," said Bounderby, "but I don't want to be too dear. That to start with. When I begin to be dear to a man, I generally find that his intention is to come over me. I am not speaking to you politely, but as you are aware, I am not polite. If you like politeness, you know where to get it. You have your gentlemen friends, you know, and they'll serve you with as much of the article as you want. I don't keep it myself."
"Bounderby," urged Mr. Gradgrind, "we are all liable to mistakes."
"I thought you couldn't make 'em," interrupted Bounderby.
"Perhaps I thought so, but I say we are all liable to mistakes, and I should feel sensible of your delicacy and grateful for it if you would spare me these references to Harthouse. I shall not associate him in our conversation with your intimacy and encouragement. Pray do not persist in connecting him with mine."
"I never mentioned his name," said Bounderby.
"Well, well," returned Mr. Gradgrind, with a patient, even a submissive air, and he sat for a little while, pondering. "Bounderby, I see reason to doubt whether we have ever quite understood Louisa."
"Who do you mean by we?"
"Let me say I, then," he returned, in answer to the coarsely blurted question. "I doubt whether I have understood Louisa. I doubt whether I have been quite right in the manner of her education."
"There you hit it," returned Bounderby. "There I agree with you. You have found it out at last, have you? Education? I'll tell you what education is. To be tumbled out of doors, neck and crop, and put upon the shortest allowance of everything except blows. That is what I call education."
"I think your good sense will perceive," Mr. Gradgrind remonstrated in all humility, "that whatever the merits of such a system may be, it would be difficult of general application to girls."
"I don't see it at all, sir," returned the obstinate Bounderby.
"Well," sighed Mr. Gradgrind, "we will not enter into the question. I assure you, I have no desire to be controversial. I seek to repair what is amiss, if I possibly can, and I hope you will assist me in a good spirit, Bounderby, for I have been very much distressed."
"I don't understand you yet,"
said Bounderby with determined obstinacy, "and therefore I won't make any promises."
"In the course of a few hours, my dear Bounderby," Mr. Gradgrind proceeded, in the same depressed and propitiatory manner, "I appear to myself to have become better informed as to Louisa's character than in previous years. The enlightenment has been painfully forced upon me, and the discovery is not mine. I think there are... Bounderby, you will be surprised to hear me say this. I think there are qualities in Louisa which have been harshly neglected and a little perverted, and I would suggest to you that if you would kindly meet me in a timely endeavour to leave her to her better nature for a while, and to encourage it to develop itself by tenderness and consideration, it would be the better for the happiness of all of us. Louisa, said Mr. Gradgrind, shading his face with his hand, has always been my favourite child. The blusterous Bounderby crimsoned and swelled to such an extent on hearing these words that he seemed to be, and probably was, on the brink of a fit. With his very ears a bright purple, shot with crimson, he pent up his indignation, however, and said, "You'd like to keep her here for a time?" I had intended to recommend, my dear Bounderby, that you should allow Louisa to remain here on a visit, and be attended by Sissy, I mean, of course, Cecilia Jupe, who understands her, and in whom she trusts. "I gather from all this, Tom Gradgrind," said Bounderby, standing up with his hands in his pockets, "that you are of opinion that there's what people call some incompatibility between Lou Bounderby and myself. I fear there is at present a general incompatibility between Louisa and almost all the relations in which I have placed her," was her father's sorrowful reply. "Now look you here, Tom Gradgrind," said Bounderby the flushed, confronting him with his legs wide apart, his hands deeper in his pockets, and his hair like a hayfield wherein his windy anger was boisterous. "You have said your say. I am going to say mine. I am a Coketown man. I am Josiah Bounderby of Coketown. I know the bricks of this town, and I know the works of this town, and I know the chimneys of this town, and I know the smoke of this town, and I know the hands of this town. I know 'em all pretty well. They're real. When a man tells me anything about imaginative qualities, I always tell that man, whoever he is, that I know what he means. He means turtle soup and venison with a gold spoon, and that he wants to be set up with a coach and six. That's what your daughter wants. Since you are of opinion that she ought to have what she wants, I recommend you to provide it for her. Because, Tom Gradgrind, she will never have it from me." "Bounderby," said Mr. Gradgrind, "I hoped, after my entreaty, you would have taken a different tone."
"Just wait a bit," retorted Bounderby. "You have said your say, I believe. I heard you out. Hear me out, if you please. Don't make yourself a spectacle of unfairness as well as inconsistency, because although I am sorry to see Tom Gradgrind reduced to his present position, I should be doubly sorry to see him brought so low as that. Now, there's an incompatibility of some sort or another, I am given to understand by you, between your daughter and me. I'll give you to understand, in reply to that, that there unquestionably is an incompatibility of the first magnitude, to be summed up in this, that your daughter don't properly know her husband's merits, and is not impressed with such a sense as would become her, by George, of the honour of his alliance. That's plain speaking, I hope."
"Bounderby," urged Mr. Gradgrind, "this is unreasonable."
"Is it?" said Bounderby. "I am glad to hear you say so, because when Tom Gradgrind, with his new lights, tells me that what I say is unreasonable, I am convinced at once it must be devilish sensible. With your permission, I am going on. You know my origin, and you know that for many good years of my life I didn't want a shoeing horn in consequence of not having a shoe. Yet you may believe, or not, as you think proper, that there are ladies, born ladies, belonging to families who next to worship the ground I walk on." He discharged this like a rocket at his father-in-law's head. "Whereas your daughter," proceeded Bounderby, "is far from being a born lady." "That you know yourself. Not that I care a pinch of candle snuff about such things, for you're well aware I don't, but that such is the fact. And you, Tom Gradgrind, can't change it.
Why do I say this?
Not, I fear, observed Mr. Gradgrind in a low voice, to spare me.
Hear me out, said Bounderby, and refrain from cutting in until your turn comes round.
I say this because highly connected females have been astonished to see the way in which your daughter has conducted herself, and to witness her insensibility. They have wondered how I have suffered it, and I wonder myself now.
And I won't suffer it.
Bounderby, returned Mr. Gradgrind, rising, the less we say tonight, the better, I think.
On the contrary, Tom Gradgrind, the more we say tonight, the better, I think.
That is, the consideration checked him, till I have said all I mean to say, and then I don't care how soon we stop. I come to a question that may shorten the business. What do you mean by the proposal you made just now?
What do I mean, Bounderby?
By your visiting proposition, said Bounderby, with an inflexible jerk of the hayfield.
I mean that I hope you may be induced to arrange in a friendly manner for allowing Louisa a period of repose and reflection here, which may tend to a gradual alteration for the better in many respects.
To a softening down of your ideas of the incompatibility, said Bounderby.
If you put it in those terms.
What made you think of this? Said Bounderby.
I have already said I fear Louisa has not been understood. Is it asking too much, Bounderby, that you, so far her elder, should aid in trying to set her right? You have accepted a great charge of her, for better, for worse, for...
Mr. Bounderby may have been annoyed by the repetition of his own words to Stephen Blackpool, but he cut the quotation short with an angry start.
Come, said he. I don't want to be told about that. I know what I took her for as well as you do. Never you mind what I took her for. That's my lookout.
I was merely going on to remark, Bounderby, that we may all be more or less in the wrong, not even accepting you, and that some yielding on your part, remembering the trust you have accepted, may not only be an act of true kindness, but perhaps a debt incurred towards Louisa.
I think differently, blustered Bounderby. I'm going to finish this business according to my own opinions. Now, I don't want to make a quarrel of it with you, Tom Gradgrind. To tell you the truth, I don't think it would be worthy of my reputation to quarrel on such a subject. As to your gentleman friend, he may take himself off wherever he likes best. If he falls in my way, I shall tell him my mind. If he don't fall in my way, I shan't, for it won't be worth my while to do it.
As to your daughter, whom I made Lou Bounderby, and might have done better by leaving Lou Gradgrind, if she don't come home tomorrow by 12 o'clock at noon, I shall understand that she prefers to stay away, and I shall send her wearing apparel and so forth over here, and you'll take charge of her for the future.
What I shall say to people in general of the incompatibility that led to my so laying down the law will be this. I am Josiah Bounderby, and I had my bringing up. She's the daughter of Tom Gradgrind, and she had her bringing up, and the two horses wouldn't pull together. I'm pretty well known to be a rather an uncommon man, I believe. And most people will understand fast enough that it must be a woman rather out of the common also who in the long run would come up to my mark.
Let me seriously entreat you to reconsider this, Bounderby, urged Mr. Gradgrind, before you commit yourself to such a decision.
I always come to a decision, said Bounderby, tossing his hat on, and whatever I do at once.
I should be surprised at Tom Gradgrind's addressing such a remark to Josiah Bounderby of Coketown, knowing what he knows of him. If I could be surprised by anything Tom Gradgrind did after his making himself a party to sentimental humbug.
I have given you my decision, and I've got no more to say. Good night.
So Mr. Bounderby went home to his townhouse to bed. At 12:05 the next day, he directed Mrs. Bounderby's property to be carefully packed up and sent to Tom Gradgrind's, advertised his country retreat for sale by private contract, and resumed a bachelor life. Chapter 4. Lost. The robbery at the bank had not languished before and did not cease to occupy a front place in the attention of the principal of that establishment now. In boastful proof of his promptitude and activity as a remarkable man, and a self-made man, and a commercial wonder more admirable than Venus, who had risen out of the mud instead of the sea, he liked to show how little his domestic affairs abated his business ardour. Consequently, in the first few weeks of his resumed bachelorhood, he even advanced upon his usual display of